This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Hello and welcome to the sixth season finale of Commentary Trek Stars, a show which deals with the work of Star Trek creators outside of Star Trek. I'm Mike.
I'm John.
And today we're joined once again by Star Trek writer and veteran Eric Stillwell. How's it going, Eric?
Fantastic. How are you guys?
We're doing really well.
Yeah, glad to have you back.
Yeah.
Thank you. So is this the episode where you leave me like almost dead at the end and it's a cliffhanger?
Yeah, well, this is, let's see, the sixth season finale, so I think we're going to find your head like buried in
Mark Twain,
whatever it is.
Yeah.
Something like that. We'll figure it out next season. So we had you on a couple of times about a month or so ago to talk about Michael Piller, but we figured we should have you back to talk about you and your work on Star Trek.
So
for those people who don't know, well, we'll get into it. We'll just get into it, and we'll start at the beginning and work our way through. So, okay, you in a lot of ways seem to have, you know, lived the dream, so to speak, as far as fans are concerned. I get the impression that you're not someone who is just like, oh yeah, Star Trek, that would be a fun place to work. Like, you were a super fan from way back, right?
Way back. I think I really became a fan like in the early 1970s when I was in grade school, and I had a friend who was a huge Trek fan, and my dad was in the Air Force, and we moved around a lot. So I was living in Idaho. We were at Mountain Home Air Force Base. And, you know, most kids wanted to just get out of school and go bike riding and racing around the neighborhood. But he always wanted to go straight home and watch this show called Star Trek. So one day he convinced me to go in and watch it, and I was hooked from the very first episode. I think I was about 11 when I first saw it. So obviously we were already into the reruns, but I was not really old enough to appreciate the original run of the series. I was like 3 when it started. So the early 70s was when I really, you know, paid attention and fell in love with Star Trek. And then I was with him every day after school watching Star Trek. Well, one day we came home and Star Trek wasn't on. It was like Perry Mason had replaced Star Trek reruns. And We were just horrified. So we started a petition, and we got like 370 signatures, and we mailed it up to the TV station in Boise demanding that they put Star Trek back on. And I got this really nice letter from the station manager, and he sent some black and white PR photos of Shatner and Nimoy and promised us that as soon as, you know, a couple months would go by and Star Trek would be back, and it was. So that was the beginning of my Star Trek activism too.
So were you just like going door to door, like asking people for signatures?
You know, I know we went to school and talked to neighbors and friends and anybody that we, I don't remember if we went door to door, but we did collect about 370 some odd signatures.
Wow.
To put Star Trek back on.
And little did you know, I guess, that you were carrying on the fine tradition of getting petitions signed to keep Star Trek on the air.
So I mean, I'm wonderful. Not even sure at the time if we were old enough to be cognizant that we were watching reruns of a show in the first place. But we were all huge fans. We used to build models and run around the neighborhood and pretend like one side of the street was the Klingon Empire, and the other side was the Federation, and the Romulans were over here, and if you crossed the street, you were in the neutral zone, and we would do that for hours and hours and hours and hours.
So at what point, I mean, was it your love of Star Trek that made you want to get into the industry, or I mean, like, how did that come about? Did you want to work in television, or did you want to work on Star Trek, or...
Well, This is what's really interesting, and I was thinking about this today because I just started a permanent job at the Walt Disney Company, and of course they have the Star Wars franchise. And it reminded me that when I was young and I was a Star Trek fan, I wanted to work for NASA, and I wanted to be in the space program. And so I really sort of geared myself towards doing that. And by the time I got to high school, I actually got a nomination from Jimmy Carter to compete for an appointment to the Air Force Academy.
Oh, wow.
And my dad had been in the Air Force for 22 years. But it turns out that if you're not very good at math or sports, you can't go to the Air Force Academy. And I have absolutely no sports or athletic aptitude at all. So I was sort of crushed that my dreams of working for NASA were not going to happen. But when I was 15, that was the year Star Wars came out. And it was Star Wars, actually, that made me think. I mean, the first 5 minutes of Star Wars were the big Imperial battlecruisers like coming across the planet, chasing the Princess Leia's ship. That scene in that movie blew my mind at age 15. And that's when I thought, I'm going to go to Hollywood and like work in the movie business, right? So Star Trek, I always tell people, was a show that challenged my intellect and sort of informed my worldview. And Star Wars was what inspired me to work in Hollywood. But fortunately for me, when I was in high school, I also ran a Star Trek fan club called Starfleet, which you may have heard of because it's still going today. And apparently the Guinness Book of World Records has it listed as the world's largest sci-fi genre fan club in the world.
Oh, wow.
And I was running that when I was in high school in the beginning of my college days. And because of that, I had correspondence and communication with Gene Roddenberry's office through Susan Sackett and some of the other, some of the actors on the show and stuff. So when I graduated from college and decided to go to Hollywood, I had those connections. But my first year in LA was back in 1985, right after I graduated from college. The first year in LA was a disaster. I couldn't get a job for love nor money in the entertainment industry. And just every horrible bad thing happened. I got tickets, couldn't afford my rent, couldn't afford to register my car, could barely afford to live in LA. So I went back to Oregon, and I one day read in the newspaper that Warner Brothers was coming up to Oregon to film a Hallmark Hall of Fame TV movie. So I kept bugging and bugging and bugging them until they actually let me work on this film when it came on location up in Oregon. And to make a long story short, I ended up being a production assistant on this film. And on the day that it wrapped, they let me fly back to LA with them for the crew wrap party down in Los Angeles. But on the day before we left, I heard on the radio driving home from the location that Paramount had officially announced that they were going to do a new Star Trek series. So I immediately like put together my resume with my one film credit on it and sent it off to Susan Sackett. And she shared it with Eddie Milkus, who was one of the producers on the show. And then he shared it with Bob Justman. And I actually got called in for an interview while I was down in Los Angeles. And it was kind of exciting. But ultimately, I didn't get the job. But Bob Justman had written this lovely letter telling me that I was one of the top 10% of the candidates that he had interviewed. And what they had ended up doing was hiring two people who already worked at Paramount, who were familiar with the studio, like people from the mailroom and stuff like that. So I made it my goal when I went back to LA to get a job at the studio. And I landed a position as a studio tour guide in the guest relations department. which involved giving studio tours and also working on live shows with live audiences, like Family Ties and Cheers. And I can't even remember the names of all the shows that we had. It was like Soul Train, yeah. All these shows with live audiences. And that's how I got my foot back in the door at the studio. And one day, my boss came in and said, "You're a Trekkie, aren't you?" And I'm like, "Yeah." He's like, "Well, the producers are going to have a cast and crew screening of their pilot episode of this new Star Trek show at one of the screening rooms here on the lot. And they need two pages to do door duty and check people's names off the list. And at the end, when everybody gets in, and you guys can go in and sit in the back and watch the pilot episode. Are you interested in doing this?" And I'm like, "Am I interested in doing this?" So at that night, I was doing my door duty, wearing my little page outfit. And when Bob Justman came up, he remembered me. And he's like, "Eric, what are you doing here?" And I said, "Oh, I'm working on the lot now as a page." And he's like, "I haven't seen you like around the sets or anything." And I'm like, "Well, the sets are closed to they're closed sets. So I haven't been trying to like sneak into the sets or anything." And literally the next day I came back from doing my tour duties or whatever. And there was a message for me in the page office saying that Bob Justman called and wants you to call him back. And I called him back and he said, "One of our PAs got promoted and I was wondering if you're still interested in this job." And I think I dropped the phone or became speechless for the first time in my life. And he's like, are you there? Hello. And I'm like, "Yes, I want this job." But I went over to meet with him, and I sort of felt guilty because there's so much turnover for people who work as pages and work in the mailroom that the director of our department had made all the pages agree that when you start there that you won't look for another job for at least 6 months. And it was only like 2 months into this job when Bob Justman offered me the PA job on Star Trek. And I said, "You know, I feel really bad because I made this 6 month commitment." And Bob Justman yelled out to Carol Eisner, who was his assistant, and he's like, "Carol, bring in the stack of resumes, you know, for people who applied for the PA job." And she comes in and there's like this stack like 2 feet tall of resumes. He's like, "If you're not interested, I've got plenty of people lined up to take this position." I'm like, "Okay, I'll take it." So I literally like the next day started working on Star Trek The Next Generation. It was the 13th episode. It was October. So it was this time, like, what, 27 years ago or something?
Yeah, 27, 28 years ago, right? 87?
Because it was October of 87.
Yeah, so yeah. 28 years ago. Wow. Okay, so you get the job on Star Trek. What exactly were you doing on the show? What is it that a production assistant does? And did it differ from what you were doing on, say, you know, Cheers or Soul Train or those types of things?
Yeah, well, as a page on the live audience shows, we were just basically coordinating the audiences and getting them in their seats and helping show people to the bathrooms and making sure people stayed in their seats while the cameras are rolling and stuff like that, and managing the lines and prior to the show and after the show, getting people out of the studio. And on Star Trek, which does not have a live audience, obviously, the PAs do a lot of running around and running errands. So there's two production assistants on the show. There was me and my friend Heidi, who I've known also since grade, like from high school, junior high, who's from my same hometown, who literally got the job on Star Trek 3 days after I did because I started and then the other PA quit. So 3 days into it, I became the senior PA. And basically what we did was anything that the producers or anybody on the show needed, we ran it around. So we both had bikes, and we did a lot of like delivering of scripts and script revisions and memos and you name it. There was, back in those days, there really wasn't email, or you couldn't email scripts to people. So everything was hard copies. And we spent a lot of time like running over to the print shop, picking up scripts, running over to the writing staff to pick up the originals to take over to the print shop, and back and forth and around, and delivering memos, delivering petty cash to people. Like the actors would have petty cash reimbursements for different things, like Michael Dorn and Marina Sirtis would get reimbursed for facials, and Brent Spiner, people who wore a lot of makeup. And so every once in a while, I'd be down like at the set delivering scripts or something, and Marina would be like, "Eric, where's my petty cash?" And then I'd have to run over to the cashier's office and pick up Marina's petty cash, stuff like that. It was just whatever, if people needed lunches, if, you know, I would also frequently, like once a week, go to like a local store where they stock like sodas and snacks for the office, and load up my car with, you know, $300 worth of like office snacks and sodas, haul them back to the studio for the production office. A lot of stuff like that.
Okay. Were there any snacks or drinks? This is where my head goes in a situation like this. Were there any snacks or drinks that were forbidden? Was there anything where like somebody was like, if I ever see this, you know, lights out, like this is just...
I don't think there was any forbidden things, but there were definitely things like, if Rick Berman wants Diet Coke instead of Diet Pepsi, there better be Diet right. Coke, stuff like that. But I don't even remember what kind of snacks we used to get. But,
sure.
So yeah. I imagine that a job like that would really sort of give a fan like yourself sort of like a very cool peek behind the curtain as to, you know, what was going on. I mean, as someone who had just come in, just watched the pilot, you know, before anyone else, like, and now you were seeing like all of this like brand new Trek in a lot of ways, like what was your reaction to it?
Well, it was like, to me, the greatest thing ever, my dream come true, like unbelievable. Like I couldn't even believe that it actually happened. So it was like I'm always pinching myself, but at the same time there was a certain degree of reality that hits you right in the face when you're this excited, you know, Trekkie who gets the dream job of a lifetime, and then you run into the reality of a production team who were uncertain at this particular juncture in time whether the show would even be successful. There was a huge amount of secrecy around it, and a lot of paranoia. And so a lot of people just who work in the business don't understand fans. So they have these preconceived notions of what it means to be a fan. And so I would always get stuff like people asking me like, "Oh, how much could you get for this phaser at a Star Trek convention or whatever?" You know, and I'm like, I don't know. I don't collect stuff or sell stuff and so there were times when I actually was accused of like taking things or doing stuff that I hadn't really done. So there was sort of a certain air of beware of what you wish for because it might come true. I remember getting in trouble because Majel Barrett at the time was still running her Star Trek, Inside Star Trek club through Lincoln Enterprises. I don't know if you guys remember those days, but Majel actually ran a Star Trek fan club, and she asked me to be the editor of the newsletter while I was also working on the show, and Rick Berman found out and was like furious. "What are you doing? You can't do that. It's a conflict of interest, blah, blah, blah." And I'm like, "Okay. Gene Roddenberry's wife asked me to..."
Right. How are you going to turn that down?
Right.
Like, that's...
So there was all this kind of thing going on at the same time that it was also a really amazing experience, because some interesting things happened in the first couple of seasons. There was a writer strike and there was also a director strike. And I remember at the end of the first season, I think it was when the writer strike started, right before the end of the season, they had not finished all the scripts for the season, and we were getting ready to do the neutral zone. And Maurice Hurley, who was the head writer, came up to me at the PA table one day in the production office. And you have to imagine, the production office was like a mobile trailer thing that was offices around the outside and then a big open bullpen in the middle. And in the middle, there were four or five different desks and some tables for all the secretaries who worked for different producers and the production coordinator. And so Heidi and I sat at one of these tables and basically just ran errands for whoever needed stuff done. And so Maurice Hurley walks in one day in the production office and comes over to me and says, because they were working on the script, but the writers couldn't officially be working on it because the strike had started. And Maurice Hurley says to me, "I need a list of names for Romulans." And I'm like, "Okay." I said, "What do you want me to do? Like, make them up?" And he's like, "No, look it up in a Romulan encyclopedia." And I'm thinking, well, little do you know, someday there probably will be a Romulan. But no, I got to like make up the names for all those characters in that episode. And little things like that every now and then were a lot of fun.
So did you, I mean, you said that you had sort of a reputation for sort of being like the fan on set or whatever. Did people sort of who were making the show take advantage of that? I mean, did Maurice Hurley, for example, come specifically to you, or was it just because you were sitting there?
I think he did come to me because he knew I was a Star Trek fan.
Yeah.
But there were other fans who worked on the show too, like Mike Akuda, Richard Arnold. Oh,
yeah.
A few others. But yeah, what happened when Heidi and I became PAs is we started to sort of divvy up the errand running into different groups, because Heidi was really more interested in the stuff going on at the stage and costume making and stuff like that. And I was more interested in the writing part. So the production office was located like right in the middle of Paramount, and then the sound stages were over on the far like east side of the studio, and the writing department was on the far west side of the studio. So Heidi and I sort of agreed that I would be like the PA for the writing department, go back and forth for all their stuff, and she would do more of the sound stage kind of back and forth. And of course we intermixed our duties whenever it was required, but that's how I sort of became more involved with the writers and the people working over in the writing building, which was separate from the production office.
So that eventually led to you becoming a script coordinator on the show?
Yeah, the script coordinator on the first season, Janet Sternad, for some reason took a leave of absence and never came back. And nobody could figure out where she went or why she never came back. And so for a while, we didn't really have a script coordinator, but there was a script typist and some people in the production or in the writing department that were trying to keep it together. And then one day there was this terrible accident, and a shelf fell down on the script typist and hit her right in the face and broke her nose. Oh. And so she had to go on a medical leave of absence. And suddenly there was nobody who knew how to coordinate the office over in the writing department. So Rick Berman's assistant, Terry, convinced the producers that they should let me take over and do that. So that's how I became the script coordinator during the third season.
Was it like at the start of the third season, or
I think it started at the tail end of the second season, and then because some weird stuff happened during that season too, because then there was another strike. I'm losing track of like the timeline, but they were working on Shades of Grey, which at the time had no title. It was just called Indie Bottle Show, and they needed someone to go do research on clips that they could use to fill in between like a very skeletal script that had been drafted. So I went off, and it was assigned to me to go over to post-production and like look through every single episode that had been produced and like actually pull clips so that Rick Berman could look at clips and see what they could put into this episode. And it was in 1 week, I worked 80 hours pulling all these like clips together. And in the meantime, I actually named the episode because they were like, I don't know what we're going to call this. And I tried to convince them it should be called Riker's Brain.
That's a great reference.
Yeah, especially given the reputation it has since. Yeah.
And ironically, Mike Akuda and the guys in the art department, they were designing that machine that Riker was going to have his head stuck into. And they had created this thing that looked exactly like the sphere with all the things sticking out of it from Spock's brain. And they almost got it past everybody because most of the producers had no realization the similarities to Spock's brain. But somebody figured it out and they decided not to do that. So I eventually said, well, let's call it Shades of Gray. There's no black or white to this episode. But, okay. So that was my very first screen credit, because I went to David Livingston and I said, I worked my ass off on this episode. I think I should get a screen credit. And he's like, well, what do you think your credit should be? And I said, well, researcher or something like that. So I did get the credit. And shortly thereafter, Richard Arnold got his screen credit as researcher for every episode after that. But then I became the script coordinator, and then I had my credit on the show too.
It's sort of been documented because there was that the chaos on the bridge that came out and everything. From your perspective, some of the tumult that was going on, how apparent was that from your point of view? Like, you were obviously there during a time where there was substantial dust and some movement and, some different opinions about direction of the show and that sort of thing. Like, how obvious was that? Or was that all kept very much behind closed doors for a few people?
Well, there was always stuff going on that was beyond my purview because I was at the low end of the totem. But there was also stuff that you couldn't help but notice. For example, when I started as a PA on the 13th episode of the first season, it was the same exact week that David Gerald and DC Fontana were leading the show under not so great of circumstances. And I didn't know all the details of what had gone on prior to my arrival. I just knew that something bad was going on, and I had basically been warned not to hang around them for fear of being associated with the wrong people or whatever. And so that's when I suddenly realized, because I was so naive, I guess, as a Trek fan who had this belief in how humans will be better and the future will be better. Somehow I just thought working on Star Trek would be like that, but it wasn't. It's just typical nasty 20th century politics. And so I was sort of disillusioned relatively quickly into the process, because there always seemed like there was some crisis going on, whether it was a writer strike or a director strike or, you know, but once the show actually launched, they knew we were successful, and but it was still tentative for the first couple of seasons, because the show didn't really get its stride until the third season. So there was always a lot of stress and tension. And at the end of the second season, Maurice Hurley had announced that he was leaving the show. And so there was a lot of tumult over who was going to replace him. And they had hired a writer named Michael Wagner to come in and replace Maurice Hurley for the third season. And when Michael Wagner came in, we were way behind. We didn't have any scripts ready. And he just couldn't handle the stress of it. And apparently a lot of it, for a lot of the writers, the stress was generated by Gene Roddenberry's feedback on the scripts and stuff, and people needing to do what he wanted them to do. And so Michael Wagner did not last very long. He just quit. And suddenly there was no head writer on the show, but I was the script coordinator. And for a few weeks, it was my job to go like over and hang out with Rick Berman and actually take all the script notes from Rick Berman and then go back and transcribe those into the scripts and stuff. Because there was literally nobody running the writing department. And so in a weird way, it was like me and Rick Berman. And then they hired Michael Piller. And Michael came in, and Michael just sort of took the bull by the horns and decided to get things organized. And it took a while, and it was stressful on the staff who had survived the second season and were part of the third season, because they weren't used to Michael's management style. So there was always something going on that was like stressful. And when you're working on any kind of TV show, and you're typically working 10, 12, 15 hours a day, and the way television works, because of the union turnarounds for actors and directors and different people, you start at a relatively normal hour on Monday. If you work in the office, it's like coming around 8. If you're one of the actors, you've probably been in since 4 in the morning getting your makeup on. But every day, the hours run longer and longer because you have to start later and later because of the union turnarounds, because they have to have 12-hour turnarounds from the time they leave until they come back. Mm-hmm. So by Friday, sometimes you're not starting production until 1 o'clock in the afternoon, but the office staff are still coming in at 8 o'clock in the morning. But then you're there till 2 o'clock in the morning at night, because the office can't shut down while production is still going on. And there's still script revisions happening until midnight. And so it's pretty stressful. A lot of work.
Yeah,
a lot of hours.
Like, yeah.
But that's any TV show. It's not just Star Trek.
Yeah.
They're all like that.
What exactly were your duties as script coordinator? Like, how did your job change from, when you were a production assistant?
Well, the job of the script coordinator was to coordinate the typing, proofreading, printing, and distribution of all the scripts and all the revisions. And there was a script typist, so I didn't have to do everything, but I helped with a lot of the transcriptions. And depending on the writer of a particular episode, it just depends on what that particular writer's style was like. For Michael would handwrite all of his notes in a script and then just hand it to me. And then I would work with the script typist and they integrate all those changes into the scripts. Some writers would do it on a computer and then just hand you a disc. And then you would have to proofread it against the last version of the script to make sure that you marked any changes that occurred. Because every time there's any change in the script, you have to put an asterisk on the right column of the page on every single line that there's a change, so that the actors can see like instantly, like if their lines have changed or if the direction has changed. And so there's a lot of proofreading involved and tedious back and forth. And the producers and writers are always on one level of existence, and they're communicating with the production office who's waiting for script changes that have been requested, could be holding up production, which is costing thousands of dollars an hour. And the writers will finish handwriting their notes and then call production and say, the revisions are done, except they're not done because they haven't even been transcribed into the script yet. And so then, you know, Mary Howard or one of the other producers would be calling every 10 minutes. Are the changes ready? Are the scripts ready? It's just like, I'm going to strangle you. It's like, when they're ready, you will actually get them. Because we're not just sitting on them going, yeah. So, yeah, there was some, you know, times when I would get a little hot under the collar. You know, it wasn't all fun and games.
But at the same time, I imagine, especially as a Star Trek fan and someone who's interested in the writing process and everything like that, it must have been fascinating to see, you know, for one thing, I mean, you're getting sort of like a sneak peek at what's to come, but also just sort of like the process and the way that a script evolves and all that stuff. I imagine that must have been a really good learning experience, right?
It's an amazing learning experience. And and I was always allowed to make contributions and give notes and feedback on things if I had issues, because one of the jobs of being script coordinator was also checking continuity. So a lot of the writers and producers on the show weren't that familiar with the original series. So sometimes I would just have to bring to their attention that something that was said in a script contradicted something that was previously established on the show. And as Next Generation went along, more and more of that continuity checking was just for Next Generation's backstory. But like, you know, in the beginning of Next Generation, you can probably remember episodes like the one with the Gilam, where it was just like this black blob in space at the beginning.
Yeah.
And like someone says, we've never seen anything like it. And I'm like, except in the immunity syndrome from the original series, because we don't know what's in there yet, but we've seen something like this before. And I said, you can't have someone saying, we've never seen anything like this every single week when we have seen something like this. So, you know, I would give my notes. And when Jerry Taylor joined the staff of Next Generation, she wrote some really great episodes like Sarek, and I got to give some interesting feedback that she actually incorporated into the backstory, where Sarek's telling Picard about what Spock's childhood was like on Vulcan. And so I told her about the yesteryear animated episode, which a lot of times isn't considered canon. And she actually incorporated a whole bunch of that backstory into what Sarek was telling Picard. So I thought that was kind of cool. Because I know that those are the things that the fans love. And an average general viewer, it doesn't matter if they know it or not. It's still an interesting backstory, but at least the fans know that somebody's actually, you know, it's like Easter eggs, you know?
That's super cool.
Yeah, it shows that somebody cares. Like that moments like that are you're right, they're so important to fans, because it feels like they haven't, you know, and obviously they have, but like it feels like, you know, they're giving the love back to you. It's like, you know, thank you for paying attention, and we're going to respect that. So that's awesome.
So I tried to do that whenever I could.
Okay, I guess this is kind of a two-part question, sort of like different sides of the same coin. I guess my first part would be, when you were typing up these scripts or whatever, was there ever a moment, I'm sure there were a lot of moments, but is there one in particular where you were sitting there doing the typing and then you read something and you were just like, oh crap, this is going to be the most amazing thing ever, you know, something like that.
Well, you know,
even if it ended up not being the most amazing thing ever, you know, but you know, when you were reading it, it seemed like it would be.
It's hard. I can't remember things that far back in time, but I just have to say, there's so much going on, and you don't really, you're trying to go as fast as possible. You're working, because you're always, like, in production, working on three different episodes simultaneously. You're working on prep for the episode that has to shoot next week. You're working on the one that's shooting right now, and there's post-production going on for the episode that just finished, plus the other ones that haven't aired yet. And so there's so many things going on. I think when you're right in the middle of it, you lose perspective a little bit. Yeah. And another thing that happened was when Michael Piller became the head writer on the show, third season when Michael started, we were so far behind and there were no scripts that Michael convinced the studio to open it up, to let him open up submissions to freelance writers, whether or not they had agents, which is sort of unheard of. I mean, it is unheard of. Like, no studio does that. But Michael really twisted their arms and said, I need to open up this process and get some fresh ideas in here. Because so many people who were professional writers were coming in to pitch for the show, but they just didn't know Star Trek. And Michael's like, if we at least open it up to anybody who wants to submit a script, we might start seeing some stuff from people who know what Star Trek is about. And one of those spec scripts was Ron Moore's script. I forgot the title of it, but
the
bonding, yeah. Where the kid's mother dies on an away mission. And so that was sort of like a huge thing to see. And Ron was a huge Star Trek fan. So I found out while we were working together that back in the days when I was running Starfleet, he was an ensign. Oh, wow. and we found someone found his like Starfleet certificate that I had signed with his name on it. And we put it in, there was this inbox for all the writers, like downstairs in one of the offices that everybody went into to pick up their mail and stuff. And it was so funny when Ron saw that in his inbox, he was like mortified, because it was like he didn't want people to know that he was such like tricky and it was like when he saw that, he knew everybody knows. So there was like fun stuff like that that would happen. And so then during this process, I might as well just jump to yesterday's Enterprise happened.
Yeah.
So I think it was the third season, and that fall, whatever year that Star Trek V came out.
Okay, 89, I think.
It was 1989. Yeah. Same summer as Ghostbusters 2, Indiana Jones, The Last Crusade, and Batman.
Was it in June or spring?
It came out in June.
So I had met this other guy, Trent, who was had submitted a spec script called Yesterday's Enterprise. And we were getting so many spec scripts. There were like thousands of them. And I had to process all the, log them all in. And I didn't actually read them, but I just had to make sure that they got distributed around to different producers and writers on the show who were supposed to read through them and then let Michael Piller know if there was anything interesting going on. But scripts would just sit around lingering on people's desks for like months and months and months and months. And I can't remember even how I met Trent, but I remember he was also a studio page, and we had all gone to a screening of Star Trek V, a studio screening for employees. And we were all so disappointed in that movie that we actually ended up going to one of those 24-hour diners on Sunset Boulevard on the Sunset Strip until like 4 o'clock in the morning, just like, like taking this whole thing apart. And so eventually we were just like, you know what? We can write a better Star Trek than that. So we're like, so he was telling me about his spec script, Yesterday's Enterprise. And I was telling him about a story that I had been working on where I wanted to bring back Sarek in a Guardian of Forever kind of story. And the two of us just started like working together. And his spec script was still sort of floundering around the office. But we both ended up going to a Star Trek convention up in San Jose, which was his hometown. And Denise Crosby was the guest at the convention. And afterwards, they went by to say hi to her. And I forgot to mention that during the first season, I was also helping Denise Crosby run her fan club on the side. So I used to process all the fan mail and send out all the autographed photos. So I was doing all that on the side. I don't think Rick Berman ever found out about that one. So when I saw Denise up in San Jose, she had started hinting that she would love to come back on the show as a guest star. And so she said, you should write a script and bring me back. And so Trent and I were like, how could we do that? You know, like it would have to be like a time travel story or something. So we started contemplating the story that I had been working on that involved the Enterprise escorting Sarek to the Guardian planet to pick up a team of Vulcan archaeologists who had been researching ancient Vulcan history. And of course, in the process, something happens, there's an accident, and Sarek, who was the founder of modern Vulcan philosophy, gets killed prematurely in the past. And instantly, the universe like switches over to a Romulan Vulcan Empire that has wiped out the Klingons and is on the verge of like wiping out the Federation. Of course, everything has changed up in space, but not on the planet. And so Sarek, who was on the planet, realizes that something has gone horribly wrong. But meanwhile, Picard now thinks they've just captured a Romulan spy right on the planet, trying to access the Guardian of Forever so that they can destroy the Federation. And so this whole drama happens. But meanwhile, Tasha's alive and back on the ship, and Worf is gone because the Klingons have been wiped out by the Romulan Empire. And then there's this whole story that ensues with Sarek trying to convince Picard that this is all wrong, and Picard doesn't believe him, and Sarek's like, well, let me do a mind meld with you, and then you'll know that I'm telling you the truth. And Riker's like, no, he's just trying to steal the secret codes so he can destroy the Federation. And so there's like all this drama. And so we were like working on the start of this idea. And a few weeks later, I got wind that Denise Crosby's agent had contacted the producers, and Rick Berman had sent a memo over to Michael Piller saying, Denise Crosby wants to come back on the show. Do you guys like have any idea how we could possibly do that? And when I heard about that, I was just like, oh my God, I gotta go tell Michael the story, right? So I went in and just walked into Michael's office, and he said, What is it? And I'm like, I just need a minute to tell you, you know, that Trent and I have been working on the story, blah, blah, blah. So I told him this whole story, and Michael was already aware of Trent's spec script because it had finally worked its way up to his desk, and Michael was trying to convince Rick Berman to consider doing a story about a ship from the past. But in Trent's spec script, the Enterprise C had come through time, but it didn't alter the universe. But there was the risk of it changing the timeline somehow if we didn't send them back. And it became more of a moral dilemma about sending them back to a battle where they would die and whether or not we should tell them or not tell them or not send them. So it was more of a moral dilemma kind of story, but there was no time travel. There was no Tasha, none of that. So Michael listened to my pitch, and then he's like, Michael always would hate anything to do with the original series because he thought it was a gimmick. Like, it's a gimmick. We can't use the Guardian. Can't use Sarek. But he's like, but what if you like do like combine Trent's story and your story together, and somehow when the ship comes through time, it alters the future and Tasha's alive. And we're like, okay. So that's sort of how yesterday's Enterprise like came about. And then it was Michael's idea, because we were like, well, how will anybody know that the timeline has changed? And Michael finally came up with the idea that Guinan would be like an extra sensory, you know, perception of some sort. And so everybody was involved in sort of making yesterday's Enterprise come to fruition.
That's, I mean, awesome. That's an amazing story. I mean, yeah. And the fact that it then became, I mean, certainly at the time, you know, the best hour of Next Generation, you know, up until that point, and still to this day, one of the best hours in Star Trek history. I mean,
yeah,
that's, I mean, that's just an amazing story, you know?
Well, and this is where that whole perspective thing comes into play. Because this was all going on in October, 26 years ago today, like in the month of October. Trent and I were turning in stories, and Michael was giving notes back, and then we turned in our final draft, and then they turned it over to Ron Moore to polish up the story, and he made some improvements to it. And then the notion was they were going to be shooting it in January, and that they had scheduled a time, and then it turned out that Denise and Whoopi weren't both available that week, and the only week that they could do it was the first week of December, which was 5 weeks earlier than they had planned. So Michael basically told the writing staff that they had to have it by at the end of Thanksgiving weekend. And so Ira Bear, Ron Moore, Hans Beimler, and Richard Manning all, and Michael all took a piece of the, they broke the story and they all took an act home Thanksgiving weekend, which made nobody happy. And they came back on a Monday morning, like a few days before we were supposed to start shooting. And we're like, here it is, just stick it together. And so everybody's notion was, this is going to suck. It's like a hodgepodge of, it's like, you know, random pieces that we just stuck together. And I literally, people were moping around like, this is going to be like the worst episode ever. And you know, like, if you ever go to a movie and you see like 12 names of on the writing credit, mm-hmm. you know it's gonna suck, because it's been rewritten and rewritten and rewritten, and so it always means something terrible. But in this particular case, it actually turned out well, and Michael didn't get a credit because the Writers Guild said that they could only have 4 names on the credit, and technically they were only allowing 3 names, but Hans Beimler and Richard Manning are a writing team, so they counted as one, and then Ira and Ron got the other part, and then Trent and I got the story credit.
So, seeing as how, you know, you're still doing your day job as you know, script supervisor and everything, were you like then having to like see what all of these revisions are and like put them together for your own script? And
yeah,
like what were you thinking as you were seeing other people, like, you know, tinker with your story?
Well, first I was very impressed with Rod Moore did a fantastic job of like polishing up the storyline, because the whole Guinan thing really helped improve the story, because some of the first drafts that Trent and I had written were, we were trying to figure out how are they going to know that time has been altered? And so we had all these clunky notion that before the Enterprise C comes through the spatial anomaly, that the Enterprise had sent a probe into it, and then the probe had come back, and so there was some like recorded, but it was just too technical and blah blah blah, boring. And so when Michael introduced the dynamic element, I think that really added a dimension of, you know, humanity and interpersonal conflict that was really fantastic for the story. But Ron really fleshed it in and did a great job. So I was generally impressed, and then I actually was allowed to give notes on some things where I was able to point out some contradictions about if so-and-so had been alive 20 years ago. You know, I can't remember specifics. I think I talk about it a little bit in the book that I wrote about the making of Yesterday's Enterprise. But there were other people like Mike Kuda and Rick Sternbach who were submitting notes about spatial anomalies and what would happen if there was a rip in the time, space-time continuum, whatever. So there was like a lot of people who were just really sort of excited about this episode. Oh my God, the way the construction people and the set designers just sort of ripped the whole place apart and like built things that we never even envisioned in the original script because we thought it would be too expensive to do. So the cool part was when the episode was finally finished and the producers would usually get a VHS copy of the episode like a week or a few days before it actually aired. So I hadn't seen it yet. And one day, Susan Sackett, who was Gene Roddenberry's executive assistant, called on my phone and said, "Gene wants to see you in his office." And usually when the executive producer wants to see you, you're like, "Oh my God, what did I do?" I'm like, I'm in trouble now. So I was like, because I knew it wasn't my birthday. Because that's the only other time you got called into the executive producer's office is if it was your birthday. And they're going to surprise you. But Susan had arranged a surprise viewing party with all the writers. And Trent, she had invited Trent. And she had gotten the cake and it said, "Congratulations, Eric and Trent," blah, blah, blah. And we actually got to sit and watch the episode with Gene Roddenberry. Wow. And all the writers, Michael, Ron, all the guys. So that is probably like the highlight of my entire career, that moment that day. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And of course, especially that moment when everybody turns to Gene and goes, "What did you think, Gene?" And you're like, "Did he like it?" And he said he did. So
excellent, excellent. And it's so, I mean, because it has such a unique, you know, so many unique elements to it. It's like the Enterprise C, for example, right? Like you can have, I'm sure you probably do have like a bunch of like toys and keepsakes, which are specific to your episode. That's so awesome, you know?
I know there were things that came out that I never imagined. Like the California State Lottery had Enterprise Starship like lottery tickets, and there was an Enterprise C lottery ticket, and there have been all sorts of stuff like that over the years. I mean, this year is actually the 25th anniversary, and so it's kind of amazing. Yeah. I don't know if do you guys ever listen to the mission logs?
We they're on the network as well. Yeah,
so this last week was Yesterday's Enterprise.
Oh, was it? Oh, see,
And they did a really nice job, I thought, of critiquing the episode. Because they basically jumped right to the conclusion at the beginning that, yes, it passed the smell test. So.
Yeah. It's really cool. I mean, it is definitely, you know, one of the best for sure. This isn't the only episode of Star Trek that you wrote. You also wrote an episode of a Voyager in season one, right?
Yeah, first season.
And it was Prime Factors with David R. George III, who's, you know, now he's written a ton of Star Trek mm-hmm. books and everything, too, including one with you. But yep. How did that one come about?
Well, We had worked together, David and I, pitching a bunch of different stories for Deep Space Nine, which never came to fruition. Although there were some stories that we had pitched that did come to fruition that we didn't get credit for. particularly the one about Jadzia, you know, meeting the reincarnation of one of her past people when it became a woman.
Mm-hmm.
And we had pitched that multiple times. And anyway, I'll skip right past all of the negative stories to when Voyager came along. We got invited in the pitch, so we worked on some stories. And I had this idea that was inspired by the original series episode Assignment Earth, because of the one with Gary Seven,
yeah.
who had been taken as a child by aliens to another planet on the other side of the galaxy. And then apparently he wasn't the only one. They had taken multiple people and raised them to come back and sort of like run interference for critical moments in Earth's history. And at the very end of the episode, when he gets beamed off the transporter pad by the alien transporter, Kirk says to Scotty, you know, trace the where that came from, right? And Scotty says something like, it came from so far away that our sensors don't go that far. And at that very moment, I'm thinking, so somewhere out there on the other side of the galaxy is a civilization with a transporter technology that can beam people like halfway across the galaxy. And what if Voyager like encounters these people, and it's the aliens from that who took Gary Seven, right? And of course, you know, typical Michael Piller. Oh, it's a gimmick from the original Star Trek. We don't want to use this gimmick, but he liked the general premise that the Enterprise goes to this planet that has this technology, but they won't let us use it because they've got their own version of a prime directive that would be interfering with us because we haven't developed that far yet. Mm-hmm. And so I always thought, well, it would be interesting to turn the prime directive upside down on its head and see how we would like it if we were on the other end of it. And so that was the premise for the story. And we pitched it to Michael and Jerry, and they liked it enough that Michael said, we need you to come back and re-pitch it, but coming from sort of like a Sierra Madre point of view. So we went home and rented The Treasure of Sierra Madre and watched this whole thing. And of course, at the end of The Treasure of Sierra Madre, it was like, it was fool's gold instead of real gold, right? So we thought, okay, well, that's what Michael wants it to be, so we'll go back, pitch this. And the second time around, we were only pitching to Jerry Taylor, and we're like pitching the story, and she's like, that's not what Michael wanted. And I'm like, but it is what Michael wanted. He told us to go watch Treasure of Sierra Madre, and that's exactly what The Treasure of Sierra Madre is about. I don't know. Anyhow, somehow she did agree to buy the story, and we got to write the story. But then they actually turned it over to two other freelance writers to rewrite it. And when it came in, it really hadn't changed all that much from the version that David and I had written. And when the credits had come in, and that was one of the things that was my job as a script coordinator on Next Generation, was to submit the credit proposals to the Writers Guild. But when I saw that these other writers were getting like half the story credit, even though they really didn't change anything, we actually contested it with the Writers Guild, and David and I won the arbitration and got sole story credit for that episode. But I really enjoyed how it turned out, especially the scene with Tuvok and Janeway at the end of the episode.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was good because it kind of, I mean, obviously, you know, people are very critical of Voyager for kind of dropping the conflict between the Maquis and the Federation fairly early on. But this is one of those episodes which, you know, really does sort of touch on that and everything. And it's a solid, you know, especially like, you know, that Star Trek thing of like the ethical dilemma and everything like that. Mm-hmm. And it's a solid episode for sure.
Yeah. So we were happy with that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a good episode.
And it also got nominated for a Sci-Fi Universe Award.
I didn't know. There you go. Yeah.
Because yeah. Remember, there used to be a magazine like Sci-Fi Universe.
I remember it well. It was published by like Larry Flint or something like that.
Larry Flint.
No, that was a Mark, really good magazine.
I think it was Mark Altman.
Mark Altman. Yeah, he was the That I remember that very well. It's one of my favorite magazines in high school for sure.
I can't remember how many years they had award ceremonies, but it was pretty cool to be nominated for that.
Yeah. Okay. I know we've been running long, so I have one final question for you, which is open-ended, I guess, to say the least. But okay, as someone who has worked on Star Trek for years and has seen the process and everything, as well as being a fan, as well as, you know, having co-written like one of the best episodes ever and all that stuff. Okay, let's say CBS were to just hand you the keys to the kingdom, say, okay, you're the new Rick Berman, go make us a Star Trek show. What do you do? I'm not saying like even necessarily like, well, I would do specifically this, but like, would you hire certain people or would you insist on a certain premise or what would you do?
Well, I mean, that I've contemplated this many times in my life, especially when all the sequels were being developed and like, mm-hmm. what would I do? And I remember even being approached by some people way back before Next Generation came along. There were some fans who were trying to put together ideas of what a new Star Trek show would be like, even back in the early 80s or late 70s. And I have to say that I really thought it was sort of a mistake when they did Enterprise and decided to go back and do a prequel series, because you just run into too many issues with continuity and the fact that you can't make anything really look like it did and make it seem like it fits together because of the advances in television production, special effects, whatever. So I always sort of wasn't really happy about that idea, although I've always thought it would be really cool if they did a series and made it look like the original series, kind of like they did with Trials and Tribulations and that other crossover episode they did. If you really went back and sort of recreated the whole look of the original series, I think that would be cool. But I've always thought the next thing should be like another sort of giant leap into the future, like into the 25th century, where you send like the very first ship off to another galaxy somehow through whatever kind of, you know, spatial phenomenon or technology that you can develop that will get you to a place where instead of being lost in space, you're actually purposely going, but you're so far removed from the home base that it's more like the original Star Trek, where you're boldly going where no one's gone before, but start with a fresh slate, no Klingon, no Romulan, no Klingon, you know, start in a new galaxy with a super advanced ship. I always thought it would be cool, like instead of turbo shafts and stuff, like going around the ship, that the doors would just be like an energy field and you would say to it where you wanted to go and you would walk through it and come out in the other set. And I know that sort of, I mean, you have to think about these things because the turbo shaft has been used as a dramatic tool to give people time to have these little interstitial conversations between, you know, locations. So if you suddenly have technology that takes that away, you have to think about what the alternatives would be in the storytelling process. But that's kind of my idea, that it would just be a super streamlined, futuristic starship with like technology like we've never seen before, going out to another galaxy far away and being out on it on its own to do its thing.
Interesting. So no JJ verse. Go no. back to the prime. Yeah.
No light flashes.
So no lens flares.
No lens flare.
Okay. Fair enough.
I think we've sort of exhausted the universe that we live in with Star Trek. Mm-hmm. I mean, I kind of liked the idea when JJ in the first movie decided to create an alternate reality where you could sort of start fresh and not worry about all those continuity issues. Mm-hmm. But I was terribly disappointed with the second movie. I thought it was too much of a rehash of where we've gone before. It's not where nobody's gone before. It's where we've already been, you know. Yeah. And I hope the next one doesn't repeat that mistake, but we'll see.
We shall see. Yeah.
We'll see.
Well, thank you very much for joining us today. It's been very educational. It's so great to kind of like, you know, get that peek behind the scenes and see what goes into the making of, you know, our favorite TV shows, you know. So
thank you for having me.
Oh yeah, it's been great. And you're more than welcome back anytime. Oh, well, that was really great talking to Eric again today. It's so cool to see what went on behind the scenes, and like someone, it's like he was there for all of it. Like he saw like everything that we love. Like he saw it from like the very beginning. Like as soon as it came out of the writer's pens, like he had like the first set of eyes on it. That's crazy, you know.
Yeah, he got to watch these things that are basically like memories for us form from the very first, and you know, and he was there like at, you know, such a pivotal time for Star Trek as well, like the series as a whole, but you know, while Next Generation is finding its footing. So he actually got to witness, you know, what we consider like such an important piece of history firsthand. That's just so neat.
Yeah. And the story of him not just, you know, working on the show, but then like the creation of Yesterday's Enterprise. Mm-hmm. It's just like, how does this happen? Like, how does the universe like unfold in such a way to make that happen, you know, and to give us like one of the best hours in television history. That's so cool.
Yeah, it is.
Well, it was great talking to Eric. But hey, we're not done yet. You know, this is the jam-packed season finale of Commentary Trek Stars. And we started off the season by talking to another Star Trek creator, and that was James Caan, who had worked on Voyager, as well as writing, you know, like the adaptation, the novelization of Return of the Jedi and whatnot. And as we mentioned back then, and we talked about a couple weeks ago as well, he's trying to get a new movie off the ground called Wrong Side Bob, which he's writing and co-directing. And it stars another Star Trek alum, Ronnie Cox, who played Captain Jellicoe in Chain of Command. So before we go, we have a brief interview with James where he discusses Wrong Side Bob and gives you a little bit more info on that project. So let's hand it over to I guess, myself and James.
Yeah.
Hey, everyone. I'm back with James Caan, who was a writer and producer on Star Trek Voyager. We talked to him a few months back about his work on Star Trek as well as the rest of his career. And he's back to talk about his new project, Wrong Side Bob. How's it going, James?
Good. How you doing?
I'm doing well. Thanks for coming on the show. So tell us, what is Wrong Side Bob?
Wrong Side Bob was actually initially a CD I wrote and produced a few years ago called Man Walks Into a Bar. And it was a concept album in which every song on the album was about one of the people in this bar on this given night. And the way they were all story songs, and the way their stories intermingled, and then there was kind of a meta story that connected them all at the end. It's basically roots music, some folk music, some blues, some country. And I tried to write each song in the genre of that character. So the dancer was in a blues, and there was a bartender who was kind of jazzier, and there was a kid who hung out there who was more of a folk music kind of kid. And ever since I did it, people have been telling me I needed to do either a screenplay or a stage musical out of it. And I finally took that to heart and wrote a feature film script, which I called Wrong Side Bob, which is one of the characters. He's actually more of a minor character in the CD. I make him one of the lead characters in the movie.
So this is a project which you're trying to fund right now on Indiegogo, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Okay. And it stars Ronnie Cox?
Yes, Ronnie is, we didn't actually ever cross paths on Star Trek. He was Captain Jellico in The Next Generation.
Yeah.
I did write one freelance episode for TNG, but I was really not involved majorly in Star Trek until Voyager. But I crossed paths with Ronnie because he was also a singer-songwriter. And he's actually been spending more of his time in recent years touring with his folk music than acting in film. And I saw him at a house concert about a year ago and thought, boy, he would be just perfect for the title role of Wrong Side Bob, who's this quirky old barfly of a certain age who'd sort of use the... He likes to say he's the mayor of the bar. That's just right for him.
Yeah, you know, I obviously among Star Trek fans, you know, people love Ronnie Cox because of that role, and it's kind of great to see him, you know, whenever he's in anything. But the fact that he is a musician himself, I wasn't aware of that. Does that play into the story at all? I mean, since this is based on a on an album, is it very musical in nature?
It's very, very musical. It's I wouldn't call it a musical, but it's a musical in the same way that Oh Brother, Where Art Thou was a musical. It's kind of a comedy drama. There's a lot of music in it. Some of it is a little bit surreal, where you know you wouldn't expect music to suddenly start happening. Some of it is source music, as if coming from a jukebox. But so some of, you know, a number of the songs in it will be my songs from that album. But because Ronnie is such a terrific singer-songwriter himself, he'll be doing one of his songs too.
Are you going to be like re-recording the songs that you did on the album to fit into here, or is it actually incorporating the music from the album?
Some of both. For example, some of the songs in the album are sung by Wrong Side Bob, Ronnie's character, so we'll probably use the production tracks for that, but just have him revoice it.
That's really interesting. Now, since this movie is based on an album, I mean, I guess there's this is kind of a two-part question. First off, it's an adaptation, which is something that you've done a lot in your career, where you've adapted work from one medium into another, which I'm sure has all sorts of, you know, interesting challenges to it. But this is kind of taking that to another level where, I mean, I know that you said that the album was kind of a story album or story songs or whatever, but still, it seems like it's a bit of a jump in terms of...
It is a jump, and it's... I really enjoy the adaptation process, but it takes some skill, and it's not easy at first. I remember when I was adapting the Poltergeist screenplay to the novelization, I had all these additional storylines and relationships and subplots that weren't in the movie at all that I wanted to introduce. And Spielberg said, you know, fine, go for it, but it demands, you know, once something is in print, it's hard to unthink it and unsee it. So it was hard in a way to undo some of the things that were already in the script to take the story in slightly different directions. And it was the same with this album. There was a more or less a story in my album, but that specific story didn't exactly work for a screenplay. So I had to drop elements of it. As I say, the main character in the album still has a very large role in the movie, but the title role is this minor character from the album who just had one song in the album. So it required, you know, rethinking where it went. I had to introduce a couple brand new characters who weren't in the album at all. You know, I had to bring in a bad guy, for example.
was the fact that you were adapting your own work either more or less of a challenge than adapting someone else's work?
Yeah, I found it more of a challenge, actually. It's easier adapting someone else's because of I disagree or don't like or something they've done or I think it should go in a different direction. It's easier for me to say, well, that didn't work in the original. I can just take it this way. That's better. Once my own stuff is, it's not exactly set in stone, but it's hardwired into my brain a little bit more. It's harder to undo it.
Now that you've gone through the process, I'm sure just like with any creative process, you're now sort of like rethinking what you did originally on the album. Have you considered maybe like recording an extra track or even do you just think like, oh, I wish I could, but now the time has passed?
Yeah, no, it's occurred to me that what I should do now is a soundtrack album for the movie that would, yeah, would have some of the songs from the original album, but the additional songs that I would write and some other people's songs as well.
That would be cool for sure. So in addition to, you said that you've got the campaign going right now on Indiegogo. In addition to that, I saw that 1% of the contributions are going to go to the Enable Community Foundation.
Right. That was a great piece of happenstance. They contacted me initially just asking if I would start publicizing their good works. And looking into it, they 3D print prosthetic hands, functioning prosthetic hands, and give them away free to kids who need them, kids who don't have hands or arms. And I think they contacted me because of my medical background, because I'm a doctor as well. But that what struck me immediately about that was that, you know, after Luke Skywalker had his hand cut off by Darth Vader, he got a prosthetic hand and then went on to save the galaxy. It seemed like a perfect kind of crossover, cross promotion, and a meshing of messages and just sort of heart. So yeah, so we got together, and I'm giving a portion of our proceeds from the Indiegogo campaign to them.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Yeah, for sure. So if people are looking for more info on the project or looking to contribute, where can they go to find some info?
Yeah, just go to Indiegogo, and it's the Wrong Side Bob project. And we're giving away, you know, in addition to that whole giveaway to the Enable Community Foundation, we're giving away a lot of cool perks, unrelated really to Wrong Side Bob and having to do with my previous career. I'm giving, you know, I'll be sending out signed Return of the Jedi novelizations and some old Star Trek scripts. But I've also got a passel of transparency slides, production stills, visuals that they sent me to help me write the novelization from the set when they were filming Return of the Jedi, but they're stamped Revenge of the Jedi. At that point, it was still a title. So they're really very limited edition. I've signed them as well, but they're pretty much vintage collector's items. So those will be going as perks.
Oh,
my
yeah.
favorite perk was another complete accident that I just found hilarious, which is I got a very apologetic phone call from Random House a few weeks ago, saying that they just re-released the original trilogy of novelizations and spelled my name wrong on the cover. Spelled it K-H-A-N instead of K-A-H-N. So they caught it in time to destroy 60,000 copies that were still in the warehouse, but some thousands got out into the wild as well. So I'm taking some of those as a limited edition misprint and citing them, con! A franchise crossover to my other life.
Excellent. sounds really cool. Yeah, and up on the Indiegogo site there's a trailer and everything, which is pretty cool. Sort of like gives people a sense of the tone and everything
I like to call it noir meets country. It's kind of a new genre.
It's good. I love like genre mashing and genre bending. It feels kind of like Altman-esque in a lot of ways, you know?
Exactly.
Yeah. That's really cool. Anything else that people should know about the project or any other?
No, just, you know, it's really my first real screen project of the heart. You know, I've spent 30 years crafting and writing and producing things for other people's stories, you know, in studios. And this is the first thing that really comes from deeply within me. And there's really a way in which I feel like my music is maybe some of my best writing and closest to the heart. So it feels like a real passion project to me that I'm hoping everyone will hop on board and help me make it real.
Yeah, that's really cool. I love it when, you know, filmmakers or writers or whoever who have made, you know, a lot of, you know, studio things get to do something which is, you know, completely their own vision, because it's sort of like you're writing in the purest form in a sense.
Yeah, and it's really coming right from my heart, absolutely.
That's pretty awesome. Yeah, I can't wait to see it.
The short line of the story of it is a drifter with amnesia who's struggling to remember his past, stumbles into this bar where he meets Wrongside Bob, who's an old guy who's desperately trying to forget his past because he has kind of a dark secret.
Yeah, yeah.
So they go on a journey together.
That's pretty cool. So, all right, Indiegogo, that's where people go to get more info and to contribute. And what's the deadline? How long do they have till?
About 25 more days. Just got started about 10 days ago.
Okay, cool. Well, I'm really excited to see it once it comes out. And yeah.
Appreciate your help and support.
Oh, yeah, no problem. Thank you. And yeah, good luck.
Okay, thanks so much. Talk to you soon.
All right. Well, that was great talking to James as well. And, you know, Wrongside Bob, go, you know, contribute if you can, or if you can't contribute, you know, do some retweeting and whatnot, let your friends know, and be sure to look for that soon.
Yeah, however you can help him make this happen.
Yeah. I mean, like I said, you know, a couple weeks ago, it's like this show is all about, you know, Star Trek creators doing other things. Here's, you know, your chance to help one of those Star Trek creators do another thing. So, yeah, I'm excited. I'm excited about this movie. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
All right. Well, it was fun talking to both Eric and James today. But that's not the only thing we're talking about here on Trek FM this week. So here's a look at what you may have missed elsewhere on the network.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Yeah, he can edit the crap out of a movie. Literally. Like, that's actually how he got the job on for Nemesis, is he edited the crap out of Lara Croft, Tomb Raider, and Mission Impossible 2. And they're like, thanks, Stuart Baird.
Earl Grey.
Oh, by the way, 6 hours in, if you press shift, you'll run throughout the whole game.
Press shift when your characters are moving, and they'll actually move at a
reasonable
pace.
The orb.
If he had, like, a game card, his power, you know, like, would be higher than any other captain for their persuasion power.
You'll be like, damn, I was winning, and then he went and played a Cisco card on me.
The ready room.
Someone pointed out that this is actually the shortest title of any Star Trek episode. It's shorter than Voyager's Q squared by half a character, because the two is superscript.
We're number one. We're number one.
To the journey! It's fake intimacy.
Thank you.
It is them trying to say, Chakotay knows Janeway so well that just by fiddling her comm badge, he knows the crap's going to hit the fan. Commentary, Trek Stars.
Lost World's a terrible movie. I haven't seen Jurassic World, though.
The 602 Club.
We wake up in the middle of the night, and I pop back in episode 5, and I watch it again. Like, there's something about this movie that from even then, you know, I'd seen them all, it's all clean slate, this one was already my favorite.
Literary Treks.
It definitely starts in a very dark place, and it doesn't get much brighter at all, you know, until we get to the end, and you know, there's some hope there, but yeah, definitely it's a dark book.
Women at Warp.
There were no, oh, you're a girl, so you can't do that. It's like, well, you know what? You used to hang out with the Cardassians, or the Klingons, so let's see what that would look like. Why don't you try that on for a while?
And introducing Meta Trex.
If you're commander of a starship, 1,000 choices are going to confront you in the course of your day in the captain's chair, and you just can't ignore them. So asking ourselves whether we really have free will is just a meaningless question on that view.
I personally would like to be confronted with the choice to warp to Ryza, just saying.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out these shows and find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe and beyond. You'll find us wherever you get your podcasts. If you're an Apple user, be sure to hit the subscribe button. That helps us out greatly and makes it easier for other listeners to find the show as they search iTunes. If you're not an Apple user, we've got you covered as well. You can find our shows on Stitcher, TuneIn, SoundCloud, Windows Phone, and of course you can stream and download the MP3 file from our website and grab the RSS link as well. Another way that you can help us keep all of our shows coming to you each week is to become a patron of the network on Patreon. If you visit patreon.com/trekfm, that's patreon.com/trekfm, you'll find our current goals and different milestone contribution levels along with all the great perks we have for you. These perks include early access to content, exclusive content, producer credits, seats on our content development team, and more. We really appreciate any support you can give us and hope you'll join the team. Again, you'll find all the details at patreon.com/trekfm. If you want to contact us, you can fill out the form on trek.fm/contact, or you can leave us a voicemail. Just look in the sidebar on the show page or go to speakpipe.com/trekfm. On Twitter, you can find the network at trekfm. On Facebook, you can find the network at facebook.com/trekfm. And Facebook is also where you'll find the Babel Conference, which is our user and listener forum where we talk about everything. I just saw something on the Babel Conference where someone was talking about the 602 Club episode where you guys talk about The Empire Strikes Back, and someone's yes. like, The Lost World. It's an awesome movie.
That person is insane.
And that's what
whoever
Drew said
that is just certifiably insane.
Yeah, I believe it was Gene. And Drew was like, you and Mike Schindler are terrible people. And
I just said you were crazy. That doesn't mean you're a bad person.
Yeah, well, you know, whatever. And then, you know, I'm like, I guess I have to listen to this episode now, you know? I would have never known that if it weren't for the Babel Conference. And then Matthew Rushing gets on there and he's like, we're just kidding. No, don't take offense. And I'm like, I cannot be offended by people saying that a movie is bad or by making fun of me for that.
Well, something we touch on that episode is how you can't basically save the long knives for other discussions. Disagree about movies, but don't be nasty about it. And you know Matthew, he likes to avoid the nasty as much as possible.
Yeah, and he said, he's like, it was all in good fun. Believe me, I respect your opinion. And I said, okay, well, in that case,
he walked Lost right World. Into it.
And I said, Lost World is better than at least 4, maybe 5 Star Wars movies.
See, the thing is, this is what I like, is that the Babel Conference is a place to test somebody's true convictions about how far they're willing to be pushed.
Yeah, and then Matthew's like, you are a terrible person. Drew is right. I take back everything nice I said about you. And The Lost World is a piece of crap, and so are you. No, he didn't say that.
That sounds exactly like him. It really, and you sat back and you went, I broke you.
Yeah. Yeah, so if you want to get in on the fun, go to the Babel Conference on Facebook. Just type in the Babel Conference, that's B-A-B-E-L, into the search field on Facebook, or go to our website at trek.fm and click the discussion tab on the menu bar. John, where can people find you on the internet?
Well, you can find me on Twitter at Kessel Junkie. You can find me on another show called Words with Nerds that's on iTunes and whatnot. And actually, I have recently become a regular writer on a site called Show Vote, where I'm doing movie and TV reviews.
Fantastic. You can find me right here on Trek FM for another 7 weeks doing Standard Orbit with Drew. This week we talked to our good friend John Tenuto about a Star Trek movie that never was, Planet of the Titans, or Planet of Titans, if you prefer, which sounds like it would have been crazy. It would have been directed by Philip Kaufman and starring Toshiro Mifune as a Klingon, and it would have been amazing, but it never was. So, you know.
Only so far you're willing to take the test with franchises there, I guess.
Yeah, yeah, but go. A great story about like why it didn't get made, why it almost got made, you know, and all that stuff. So be sure to go over to Standard Orbit and check that out. You can also find me on commentarytrackstars.com doing Commentary Track Star Babies, where we do TV show commentaries. We got some X-Files going on this week. Jose Chung's from Outer Space and all that
good
stuff.
Good timing with the new X-Files promo that just dropped.
Yeah, we talk about the new show quite a bit and everything and what our expectations are and all that stuff. So yeah, be sure to head on over there and check that out. You can also find me on Twitter at Mumbles3K, or you can find the show on Twitter at ComTrackStars, or you can email us directly at ComTrackStars@gmail.com. Before we go, we'd like to ask everyone to please support our sponsor, who helps us bring Commentary, Track Stars, and all of our shows to you each week. And our sponsor for this show is Audible.com. Audible is a great way for you to read all of the books you've always wanted to read, but never thought you'd have the time for. John, what book do you have for us this week?
Well, briefly mentioned while we were talking to Eric is I decided we'll go with the adaptation of Star Trek Nemesis, written by J.M. Dillard and narrated by Boyd Gaines. In this delightful adaptation, the wedding celebration for Will Riker and Deanna Troi is interrupted when Captain Picard and crew are called to Romulus for an emergency diplomatic mission. They face a threat that could lead to the destruction of the planet Earth, and Picard comes face to face with a man who may prove to be his most dangerous adversary yet, and a surprisingly personal nemesis.
See what they did there.
Out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you want to talk about Star Trek movies that I'd like to hear the production history of there. I mean, their nemesis there right there. I want to hear all about what happened behind the scenes on that. I want to talk to the script supervisor of that movie. As a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a 30-day trial to see just how great Audible is. Just go to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Again, that's audibletrial.com/trekfm, and we thank Audible for supporting Commentary, Trek Stars, and the network. All right, so that's a wrap for Season 6. We've got one more season left of Commentary, Trek Stars. 26 episodes, just like Star Trek. You know, this has been the plan from the beginning. And we have a design for Season 7, and we are going to be doing something which we think is pretty cool. And we're going to be looking at all of the creators who are working on the newest Star Trek adventure, Star Trek Beyond, and see what the people who are now responsible for Star Trek have done in the past and what we can expect in some way or another from Star Trek's future. So we're going to kick it off in a big bad way with a series on Simon Pegg looking at his work as a writer.